Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call and talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Joining us today to answer your gardening questions, it's our own green team, Greg Ward and Fred Breglia. Greg runs Ward's Nursery, a lawn and garden resource in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. Fred Breglia, director of the Landis Arboretum in Esperance, New York. If you have any tips for the garden, strategies, we'd love to hear them. Of course, the questions are good, and we love to get as many of those as we can. Get in early, 800-348-2551, the telephone number, 1-800-348-2551. Greg and Fred, welcome back to the show.
It's great to be back.
Yeah, sure is.
You know, you learn so much on this show, even before the show. Now, I made the mistake of saying to Fred earlier that, you know, we had this little problem with some pest. It was a worm on our broccoli plants, and they were eating the leaves. And I said, everything's fine. My wife got an organic thing to take care of it. And he said, oh, if it's organic, it must be fine. But his point was, just because something's organic doesn't mean it's necessarily safe. As you said, you can't use it as a body wash, for instance.
Yeah, there's a lot of organic things that are actually quite safe, and you could wash your hands with them. Like insecticidal soap, not a big deal. Other organic pesticides can be quite dangerous, and some of them are cell mutators. And
yeah.
For instance, some of them actually are sprayed on insects and cause their mouth parts not to actually function.
Wow.
Those types of things can be quite dangerous even to humans.
So
read the label.
Exactly. That's the upshot. Read the label.
There's actually three different words they use on that label, caution, warning, and danger.
Yep.
And it's pretty uncommon to find an organic product that is labeled danger. But because that is, generally speaking, that is sort of a clue that the product's, you know, definitely not something you want to make contact with at all.
Right.
Caution, you know, certainly still all of those labels have, you know, instructions on what kinds of protective gear to wear and gloves, you know, if you're spraying the ground, rubber boots, eye protection if you're getting up over your head at all a good idea.
Now, I would think that if you were taking care of some pests in a vegetable garden, you would probably want to stay away from something that said danger on it if you plan to eat the vegetables, right?
In general, I would probably try to not use too much at all in the vegetable garden. There are some, you know, several things that are pretty benign, especially though on the things you're going to eat immediately. If you're, you know, you have basil, you have lettuce, you know, maybe you should just share a little bit, you know, and, you know, but fruits and things that you're going to harvest over time, you know, where the product's going to dissipate for, you know, a few days or a week, not a big deal.
Okay. Sometimes actually seeing a little chewing on a leaf is a good thing. I mean, that's what we look at a lot.
Oh, these
times.
Leaves, these broccoli
but
leaves
not
were
in your
gone.
Case,
I mean, they were
no.
almost gone.
Yeah, you've crossed the line. You've got, if you don't do something, you'd lose the plant.
And it's a long way until the actual broccoli appears.
Exactly.
Yeah. So I figured we better keep the plant alive.
And you describe it as this little white moth, which is, I believe, described as or referred to as cabbage moth.
Okay.
And they'll eat cabbage and broccoli and cauliflower and even a little bit of kale, though I don't think they like kale too much. From my personal experience, they not usually found on the kale, but they, as you described, this little white moth was flying around.
Yeah.
And that's the telltale sign that whatever, if your leaves are being defoliated, that to look close because there are these matching green caterpillars.
They're very tough to see.
Yeah.
I did not see them. You know, you learn so much. Now, this is maybe year three of our garden. And last year, there was one of my kids noticed a caterpillar or something on our basil. And I said, well, that's very interesting. Let's look that up. It was a kind that loves, I believe it was basil, and it just loves that. And we said, oh, it'll turn into this butterfly. And it did. And it was just a great experiment right there. My question is, how do these little critters find my little tiny garden? Where are they? And how do they gravitate toward my broccoli or my basil?
Well, in this case, probably there was an adult that flew around and laid eggs on that plant for sure.
Very interesting.
But
all right,
well, amazing.
But enough about my garden. Let's go to the phones at 800-348-2551. Linda in Albany, you're first. Linda.
Hi.
Hi.
Calling because the very tail end of last year, actually it was already the autumn, we spotted the first of what we now know must be groundhogs. And they've taken up residence, and pretty much as many times as we try to replant certain things in our garden, they're coming in and just decimating without rhyme or reason, and we never had them before, and I've heard this from a few other people, that we've never had they've been overrun by groundhogs in this area. Where are they coming from? What do we do to get rid of them? Because I haven't found anything in the various stores.
I'm going to call them woodchucks. Because there are woodchucks on the west side of the Hudson still.
They're both acceptable common names.
Okay. Not another small mammal that I think, right, from...
Well, there's a hedgehog, which is related to the porcupine.
Oh. Right.
But this groundhog is related to the woodchuck.
So, yeah, woodchucks are what we tend to refer to them as over in the Berkshires. And they love your garden, and that's very nice of you to keep replanting it for them.
Yeah.
I don't know. I
would say, you know, first off, can you fence it?
Yeah.
That would be, you know, the easiest thing.
They're not too particular. My son had a 2 foot high and set in by about 6 inches or so, the little fence, and didn't matter. They went in and the baby ones are able to climb, apparently. So
yeah, I have seen them climb 2 or 3 feet, so I would go with something a bit taller, 4 feet usually, I would say, would be a minimum. And you know, if you have woodchucks, you may have other creatures, deer in particular. So go, if you're deciding to go with a fence, you may want to go to 7, 8 feet. It seems
10-foot stone fence around your garden.
That'll work.
And also, digging it in deeper, like 6 inches, is not. It's probably pretty good for a vole, but for a woodchuck, you probably want to go down. You know, double that, anyways. But we've had really good luck over the years. Years ago when I was growing vegetables with my parents. They always just put a fence around, and we put it down probably at least a solid feet, a foot down in the ground, if not a little more. And it was in a country, there was woodchucks everywhere, and we've been able to keep them out pretty well by doing a good fence. And it's got to be taller, like Greg said, too, like usually 4 or 5 feet, and make it look good. You know, you can make a real nice gate to it, and it keeps everything out. It keeps the deer out. Keeps the bulls out.
The neighbors.
Because the alternatives.
Keep the sun out.
The alternatives are.
You're right, Linda. That's a good point.
Well, the fencing that I'm talking about wouldn't keep sun out. This would be just like
a page wire.
Wiry kind of thing. Exactly,
The alternative is to capture them, is to try to distract them, you know, do them in some way. And that's never ending. So the fence really just solves that problem.
All right, Linda, thanks.
Cool. Thank you.
Yep,
you got
good
it.
Luck. Let's go to Madeline in High Falls. Madeline, you're on.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm trying to put up a privacy screen, and I wanted some kind of evergreen, not a whole row of them, but, you know, I have a bunch of evergreens, different kinds. So I'm wondering, what would you recommend other than arborvitae that doesn't grow more than 20, 25 feet tall?
Well, how long do you want to live there for?
Well, I probably have another 20, 30 years if I'm lucky, but I want something that grows pretty quick. That's the problem.
Yeah, so what grows quickly usually grows tall also.
Oh.
And so if what I was getting at actually before was if 20 years is plenty of time and you plan to change residences or you want to maybe alter that planting or you're willing to cut the tops, shear them, then the faster plants, pine, you know, spruce, fir, are good alternatives to arborvitae. Yeah, arborvitae is not a bad.
No, arborvitae. You know, I always encourage people mixing the plants up too, so you don't try to get like one particular species because that ends up being a problem. So
why is that a problem?
Well, you end up having like, for example, if you had nothing but let's just say broccoli, for example, in your garden, you get one outbreak with the more plants you put of one particular variety is going to be a bigger magnet. If you want to think of it for the attracting insect or disease. So, and then once it's there. It just runs rampant. It goes from one to the next to the next. It's got an unbelievable amount of food source. So the more you can vary it, and when I say vary, you could keep it all kind of looking the same. You could have spruce and fir and pine all mixed together, hemlocks all mixed together. And it's going to look I think, better. It's going to have more diversity. It looks more natural. And it is going to accomplish the task pretty well. Hemlock would be another one that, you know, might be a consideration, too.
I love hemlock. I'm a little afraid of, what is that disease, aphid, something, algid?
Oh, the woolly adelgid. I don't know, where is Hive?
Ulster County.
Ulster County, I'm not sure.
South, right?
It's south. It's about 80 miles north of New York City.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. So that might not be a good choice for you then, because we do have the hemlock woolly adelgid.
Okay. What is that?
The hemlock woolly adelgid is unfortunately an invasive insect that came over, now is attacking most of our native hemlocks. It's one of many invasive problems that we have currently. And if you've ever driven the roads around our area and plot a lot of other areas too. You've seen those purple traps. Those are emerald ash borer traps. Well,
right.
This is just another one of those kind of insects. This one's a rather fuzzy insect and really quite small, right. And you wouldn't think it could kill a 400-year-old tree, but a bunch of them together kills old-growth hemlocks.
Doing a tree within, you know, 5 or 6 years, a full-grown hemlock can be gone. It seems to have some limits with cold weather. You know, it was a very warm winter, so this is a winter where they sort of expanded this year.
Ideally,
it'll get cold this next winter and sort of knock them back. In the Berkshires, that's what seems to happen. They seem to show up for a year and then they're gone, and we don't see them again for several years. Where Fred is, it's the same thing. We're in these higher altitude, you know, higher latitude areas as well. I don't know where High Falls is, but if you're up in the Catskills, it might still work out. But it's kind of
lower Catskills, really.
I know it's down there's an incredible old growth forest down part of the Minnewaska State Forest.
Uh-huh.
If you're anywhere
in my vicinity.
Yeah, and the Minnewaska has like the biggest hemlocks I've seen probably in a state. Measured them there, spent a lot of time there. 400-year-old trees. They're being decimated by
There's no way to fight this?
In a landscape, you know, you could control it, but in a forest, it's not real easy. Even if you attempted to spray the entire forest, there's always little parts of the tree where some survive and come right back out. They've experimented with beetles that attack them too, like a beneficial, which have had some success, but not real good situation in a forest.
Hey, Madeline, we got a break here, but thank you for calling. It is Vox Pop on WAMC, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Rich and Greg and your gardening questions, more on the way.
Support for the Roundtable comes from Adam Sparaker Farms, Kingston, Poughkeepsie, and Newburgh, New York. Trees, shrubs, blooming perennials and annuals, bedding plants, gardening supplies, birding supplies. AdamSparakerFarms.com. Harlow Luggage, Northampton, Massachusetts, featuring Briggs & Riley and Eagle Creek Luggage, handbags by Bagolini, leather goods, silver jewelry and gifts, and accessories by Brighton. Online, shopharlows.com. The Olana Partnership and Olana State Historic Site, presenting Panorama, Olana's Summer Arts Program for Children, July 16th through the 20th, 9 to 4, olana.org. Empire Exhibits and Displays, Albany, New York, custom exhibits, interactive displays, and commercial casework for trade shows, events, museums, and corporate interiors. EmpireExhibits.com. NPS 21, Performance Spaces for the 21st Century, Chatham, New York, presenting Walking the Dog Theater and Anton Chekhov's The Cherry Orchard, Thursdays through Sundays, July 5th through the 22nd at 8 p.m., ps21chatham.org.
It's the Gardening Show on Vox Pop. 1-800-348-2551 is our telephone number. Greg Ward and Fred Breglia here. Fred, you have a couple of quick announcements.
Yeah. One of the big events that we're getting ready for in July here at Landis Arboretum is, and we're really proud to announce this one, is that we're going to be hosting the Meadowee River Theater Company, I should say.
Okay.
At Landis Arboretum. Now, what it basically is, if you've never seen the Meadowee River Theater Company, I would recommend highly you do, because it's an incredible opportunity to see some outdoor theater.
Yeah.
And it's always a great blend of humor and science and adventure. And this year, the title for the play is going to be Communications from a Cockroach.
Ah,
and this
that old chestnut.
Oh, yeah. And we've just opened up our entire, what we call our Pine Amphitheater. It's a great amphitheater that we have where people are just can bring lawn seats and sit down and watch the show.
Hmm.
The performance incorporates a wide variety of puppet critters operated by actors. They include fleas, tarantulas, crickets, an ancient Egyptian mummy, and, of course, cockroaches.
Ah, well, now, where can we find out more? You have a website.
Visit the website, www.landisarboretum.org, and visit the Arboretum's website. We have all the details for that particular performance listed.
All right.
We have a couple of star parties also coming up and a Midsummer's Hike, all on the website. Check it out.
Beautiful. Let's go to Rich. Rich, where are you calling from?
I'm calling from town of Perth.
I'm sorry, Birch?
No, Perth, P-E-R-T-H.
Oh, Perth. Okay, it's not what it said. I had a feeling it wasn't what it said up there. Well, welcome aboard. You're here.
Thank you. All right. My question is, this past spring, most of my pine trees lost a lot of needles. They just turned brown and came off like it was fall. I've never seen that happen before. I'm wondering what caused it.
Well, first question is, do you know what kind of pine it is?
Eastern white pines.
Eastern white pines. And is it more like the tips of the pines or more the internal interior needles?
From what I can see, it's all throughout the tree. I mean, I can definitely see on the outside of the tree they came off. Throughout the entire tree, though.
They're
and
falling off.
It's not just one tree. It's multiple trees. Yeah, it looks like it let up now, but the past spring, a lot came off.
And they're falling off completely orange or brown, or are they still greenish, partly?
They're brown.
Completely.
No, they turn brown and come right off.
Yeah, well, one of the things I would have you look at is look close with the needles that have fallen and see if you could see any spots on them. You're probably going to need a hand lens to take a look at that. It may be fungal related, but if it is, you'll see some. It's like on a deciduous tree, you would see like a noticeable leaf spot if it's fungal in most cases.
And it would be dark, blackish.
It would be like, yeah, dark brown or blackish. But you, again, you might need a magnifying glass to look at the needles and kind of see it. And if you can find some that are in the process of dying, so they're not completely brown, they're like in between, that's going to be your best shot to look for this kind of thing.
There is a and they've recovered, right, and they've grown out, and so they look green but thinner than they did.
Yeah.
There is a pay attention, but there is a I don't think it's called a needle cast, but there is something that's been
blister rust
happening not in the Berkshires, but in Massachusetts. The UMass Extension has mentioned it. It's happened before where you get some needle drop. It's generally not thought to be detrimental at all, but I have no idea what it's called.
The fact that it's coming back, though, is a good sign.
Well, yeah, they lost probably, I'd say, a good 20% of their needles throughout my woods. I got about 4 acres with lots of white pines, everything from, you know, seedlings up to probably 70, 80 feet, and it just seems to have attacked them all at once. I've never seen it before. It was just suddenly this spring.
And the trunks look healthy, too?
Yeah, the trees look fine otherwise, and the drops have stopped, but it's just like a carpet on the ground.
It's definitely something that if you wanted to email the wardsnursery.com website, I could find out what it is I'm not able to name and just tell you about it a little bit more. But
okay.
In the gist of it is it's happens you know, on and off over the last few years, and this spring was touted as a heavy season for this. It's some non-threatening fungus, I believe.
All right, so it's wardsnursery.com?
Wardsnursery.com, and there's a email link there.
Okay, hey, Rich, thanks a lot for the call. Let's go to Evelyn in Copaig. Evelyn.
Yes.
Hello.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
My question is regarding miniature roses are also a climber. Both here in Copaig and in my apartment area in Westchester County by White Plains, they hardly come out in the spring with the green leaves, and within 1 month, they're dead. And I was wondering, in other words, all the leaves I've sprayed and everything else, should I just give up on them, or should I
roses, you know, everything likes roses, but are they sort of netted, so you still see the structure of the leaf?
Not the leaf, barely the stem.
Or the entire leaf is gone and the stem is gone also?
Does it appear kind of skeletonized?
Yes.
That would be Japanese beetles then, probably, right?
If it's earlier.
If it's earlier and it's all skeletonized.
There's this thing called a rose slug. It's actually not a slug. It's a little larvae, not unlike the cabbage moth larvae, that is feeding on your roses. And they come out. They love to come out around the first week of June, and they skeletonize the plant.
Well, should I just give up on them and uproot them and try some other plant?
You know, we were talking earlier about different organic products, and there's this thing called spinosad. The active ingredient is called spinosad. It comes by a couple of brand names. Bonide has a version, and Monterey has a version.
Monterey,
these are two different brand names that would have that.
I think I've seen the Monterey at the garden shop.
Yeah, and just check the active ingredient because they could put different things in there, and it's called spinosad, and it's a really benign thing to use. And if you are consistent with it, in other words, you make the applications every 4 or 5 days by the 1st of June, you will knock this thing down, and your roses will look much better.
So even if they're skeletonized, though, they'll rebound?
My suggestion at this point in the middle of early July would be to prune them back severely, maybe in half.
Right.
Water, fertilize if you haven't done that recently, but water. They'll reemerge as you see new growth, then begin the spray, because they don't go away. They're around all summer long.
Hmm.
Right.
Okay.
I found that out. Thank you so much.
Yeah, Evelyn, thank you. 800-348-2551 is our telephone number. Gene in West Taconic. You're on, Gene.
Hi there.
Hi.
I'm so glad you're on today. I've been storing up this question for you guys.
Good.
All right.
A little research online. And I happen to be listening today. I have a pink magnolia tree. I don't know specifically which one, what type it is. But I did buy it. I didn't buy it locally. I bought it online or something. But it's I planted it in 1996 or 97, and it's been really healthy. It's been flowering profusely, and it just up and died. The whole tree just up and died, all the leaves. And I really wonder what's going on with it.
There's not a single green leaf on the plant?
No.
And last year, to your knowledge, it looked fine?
Yeah, even this year it flowered.
That's got a sizable trunk to it then, probably.
I would say the diameter is about 3 or 4 inches, 3 inches.
Three inch diameter planted back in the 90s?
Yeah.
All right.
A little bigger, maybe 4 inch diameter,
all right,
three and a half inch, but not a huge trunk.
But it leafed out fine.
Yes.
Okay. Well, then there's only a couple things that could possibly have caused something along those lines. Was it a fast kind of death? It leafed out,
yes.
Looked good, and then it kind of shut down?
I didn't even notice it, and then all of a sudden I noticed it.
Showing like a wilt symptom probably first?
I didn't notice. All of a sudden I just saw all the leaves were brown and shriveled. And
guess is that if you look around the stem of that, it may be slightly under the mulch. I don't know if you've got mulch under it or not. Is that you're going to have to find something that's probably girdled that plant.
Uh-huh.
Because there's a couple of things that would cause that, but they're all vascular related. In other words, they're, you know, in terms of nutrients and water going up to the tree. If a tree leaves out fine and then all of a sudden just dies, that would be something where the vascular tissue, you think of them as veins and arteries, have been severed. In some way. Now, they could be intact, and something else is not causing transport. But the reason why it would leaf, if that's the case, the reason why it would leaf out is that it would leaf out through the stored energy. So a plant that's going to basically be girdled, completely cut all the way around the stem, just the vascular parts, you know, the inside of these trees are all non-conductive in terms of transport. So, basically it's going to leaf out due to stored energy, and then it's going to count on, you know, the roots and stuff to pump up water after that. And if it's been girdled, that won't happen. If it was sort of declining for a while, it could be a number of things. It could have been a girdling root that finally got it. But either way you look at it, you look at the trunk of that tree, you should see either girdling, in other words, chewing all the way around it, slightly under the mulch or just above the mulch or right at the mulch line. And if you don't see that, the other thing to look for would be to see if you see a root flare. The root flare is a place where the trunk and roots come together. They kind of flare out right at ground level. If you just see the trunk going straight into the ground, no root flare, that could be potentially a girdling root. Usually that doesn't kill it all in 1 year. Usually you'd see stress symptoms building for a while and then it would die. But maybe the stress symptoms, a lot of times they're kind of not so obvious. So you might not have noticed it, and then all of a sudden it died. So I'd say check those two things. And if that all comes back, you know, oh, wow, I got a nice looking root flare, nothing's girdled, then I'd say you could try to get a hold of me at the Arboretum.
And maybe take it up. It's gone. It is not coming back. There's no shoots or anything. So digging it up will give you a better idea of any of those issues. And then the last one I was going to throw out, because we've been getting a lot of that, is a vole damage where the voles have been fed on the roots. Same situation. They fed on the roots in the wintertime. The tree was all set to go. It had enough energy to flower and put out some leaves. But because the root system was compromised, it no longer was able to keep going.
Yep. And if it is girdled, it probably would be a vole that did it.
All right. Well, good
you're
luck.
You're referring to girdling as like chewing the outside skin of the tree, right?
That's basically – or the roots.
It has to be all the way around, though, right?
It has to connect. Yeah. Or – It theoretically, if it was a big enough tree and you didn't, if you went three quarters of the way, it could start to shut down because the little piece that's left is not enough to feed the rest of the plant, thus killing it. So,
all right. Well,
but close to that.
Gene, thanks very much for the call. It's Alice in East Greenbush. Alice.
Yes. Is it too late to plant morning glory seeds?
It's never too late. They take a long time to bloom. They usually take, 60, 70 days to grow up and get, to get mature enough to actually give you a bloom. So if we're going to have a nice warm September, which you can think about, then, deciding whether that's going to happen or not, then I would say it's not too late to plant them, that they would still bloom. It would just be mid-September, possibly a little bit later.
Okay. One more quick question.
Sure.
We have a porch that we spend a lot of time on. It has like lattice stuff on the sides below the flooring. And in through the lattice, there's a big hole dug. It looks like a woodchuck hole, but I haven't seen the animal go in and out there, and I don't know where the other end of the hole goes. And I have a hard trap, and it keeps getting tripped, and nothing's in there. And I wondered how to treat that hole without having the possibility of a dead animal smelling up the place.
First of all, they're using the hole, right?
I think so.
The first thing you do is just fill it in and see if they dig it back out.
Okay.
Then you'll know if they're in there. It'd be nice to know what it is. If you don't see the woodchuck, it could be a skunk or raccoon.
That's what I was going to say. It could be a skunk possibility. The one way to tell is they make these relatively inexpensive. They call them like game cameras. They're made for like hunting.
Yeah.
Hunters a lot of times, also like photographers use them a lot. They basically, you tie them to, something that's near the place where the animal would exit. Mm-hmm. It's a camera. It's motion activated. They used to be expensive, but now they're really quite inexpensive because, technology is getting better.
Right.
And you set it up and the animal, whether it comes out daytime or nighttime, it's going to trigger it. You're going to know what you got. And then you can go from there.
That
would definitely tell you what you've got, guaranteed.
Well, call us back next month and let us know what you found. That's a good way to look for Bigfoot too, right?
It's a good way to find Bigfoot.
Yeah. You know what? We'll do a show on that too.
That's
Laura
next.
In Schenectady. Laura, you're on.
Hi. I am growing 5 mounds of pumpkins and a watermelon, and I have cucumber beetles, and they make me mad.
What do they look like, by the way?
They're little
They're definitely cucumber beetles. They look kind of like elongated ladybugs with stripes, yellow and black.
We have those too.
And I've been handpicking them, and then with lots of vulgarity, I throw them in soapy water and watch them die, and it's great.
That's terrible.
No, it's great. But I'd rather not, go through all that. Sit at my mounds and watch for bugs. It's weird.
Yeah. That's a good point. Gentlemen?
Yeah.
Well, we were just talking about what you want to spray your plants with and what you don't want to. Cucumber beetles in and of themselves don't usually do a lot of damage to any well-established plant. If it's nice and big and growing along, then sharing with them is not the end of the world. There are, I think, some I want to say viruses that they can help spread, but I've never really had an issue with that, and so I don't generally worry about them too much, I guess is what I'm saying. If the plants are young and new and small, then covering the entire plant so that it can get larger and mature with that remay or floating row cover material is very helpful. Of course, that limits pollination. Mm-hmm. So once the plant is well established and large, you do have to take it off so that the bees come in and pollinate the flowers. And so if you're at that stage, you may want to cover them for a while. Get all the beetles out first, cover them for a while, and then uncover them, in 3 or 4 weeks in time to get these crops. If they're already large and looking great.
They're all about a month old, and they all do look pretty good.
Yeah, but you're not ready for cucumbers or pumpkins yet.
Oh no. They're only just starting to flower just starting to vine.
Yeah, so I would consider the floating row cover because then you could sleep, easily. You just don't have to worry about it. There are sprays, though, that thing I mentioned before, I think, is lists cucumber beetles, that spinosad. There are some other things that you can use that are reasonably organic, and they do kill those beetles on contact, but you are spraying pesticides on your plants.
Yeah. Yep. So, another
good things too,
another thing that you might you might like to try, since you really got a kick out of the soap and the beetle thing,
nice.
Is that you actually could try another concoction called Death Juice. And basically what that one involves is you hand pick all these beetles, and then you put them in a blender with some water.
Oh, you're
killing
me.
And you put it on a food processor. And then you take that spray, actually, and put it into a spray bottle and spray it on the crops. And basically they smell there's been, you know, definitely proof that it works to some degree. They smell the dead, you know, relatives.
And, so they're dead them. Ew.
Yeah, and they stay away. So that's
can
another...
I use your blender for that? Or...
Right, that's disgusting. All right.
No, we'll talk offline on that one.
Right, Laura, thanks a lot for the call and bringing up this disgusting
but
topic.
But it does work.
I appreciate it very much. All right, listen, let's take a break here and we'll try to regroup. 800-348-2551. It's Vox Pop, The Gardening Show, 800-348-2551. More interesting advice coming up.
Support for the Roundtable comes from Hadley Garden Center, Hadley, Massachusetts. Locally owned for over 49 years, offering annuals, perennials, garden supplies, organic fertilizer, and advice. HadleyGardenCenter.com. Hudson Valley Footwear, Rhinebeck, New York. Footwear for the family, including Vibram Five Fingers, Sunita Clogs, now at Sandals. HudsonValleyShoes.com. Hills Alive, a festival of the arts. Four Southern Vermont arts groups presenting a schedule of concerts, arts and photography exhibitions, and more in venues throughout the region. HillsAlive.org. Brattleboro, Vermont, offering a wide variety of recreational and cultural experiences in small-town New England setting. BrattleboroChamber.org. And the Digital Berkshire Eagle, an online newspaper for news and information of the Berkshires and beyond. NoInkyFingers.com.
It's a violent world, this Vox Pop Gardening Show, but sometimes we have to give that kind of advice. 800-348-2551 is the telephone number. Fred Breglia is here, also Greg Ward from Ward's Nursery. Greg, what's going on at Ward's Nursery?
Well, I always sort of struggle this, wondering what to say exactly, but there's a lot of color at Ward's Nursery. It's in terms of especially perennials, a lot of woody shrubs that are coming into bloom early, a lot of hydrangeas that are blooming. Certainly, as I said, though, perennials are... It's a great time to sort of choose those colors. But earlier when you introduced the show, you said daffodils, begonias, and...
Lilies.
Lilies, thank you. So I thought I would just talk about those. Daffodils are nicely dormant right now, and you don't have to worry about them a bit. If you don't have any daffodils and you want to plant them, fall is obviously the best time.
Mm-hmm.
Lilies, in the Berkshires, we have two kinds of lilies, and here too. There's true lilies, and there are daylilies. Daylilies... The color is fantastic. They are everywhere, every color under the sun. It's really quite an amazing. Many people become a little fanatical about it and collect them,
yeah.
And it's a really fun thing to do. The true lilies, really fun as well, often very fragrant. There are some minor insect issues with them, a thing called lily leaf beetle that is becoming annoying. And then my favorite at the moment, begonias.
Yeah.
Begonias are so shade tolerant, so drought tolerant. And when I say shade tolerant, you can plant several of them in the sun. They would do just fine as well. That I think begonias are a great choice for a summer annual.
Mm, interesting. And, you know, we have the daylilies, and they don't always bloom. Some years they won't. This year they look fantastic.
It's a big year for daylilies this year, for sure.
They really had a great end of the season last year with all that rain.
I guess they liked it.
A great time for them.
800-348-2551, the telephone number. Let's go to Linda in Queensbury. Linda, you're on.
Thank you. I'm a first-time gardener, and I built myself a rock garden out in front of the house. And then I tried the landscaping cloth for part of it and decided that was way too much work and went ahead and planted all my other little plants. Well, of course, now I have grass all over the place. So my question is, do I... leave the plants in their spot until next spring to transplant and put the cloth down, or is it okay to redig up those plants in the middle of the season and put the cloth down? I don't know how to deal with
the first thing I got to say, I'm going to have a hard time not coming in on an answer with this one, because in my past life, I used to be a really heavy-duty landscaper. So before I was an arborist, I first focused on landscaping. And over all the years of doing lots of landscaping, one of the things I would advise you probably against in the long run is those weed fabrics. The reason why is because they are really quite nice, especially the ones that give you the heavy-duty ones that give you a lot of them up to like 30-year guarantees and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. But the problem with those weed barriers is that no matter what you do, weeds are going to still grow on top of that. And then every time that a plant dies and you try to transplant it, the roots of that plant are going to get up into that weed fabric. The roots of the weeds that are growing on top of the weed fabric, and it'll take 3 to 5 years before this really starts to occur, are going to get into that weed fabric, and you're going to end up having a situation that's a lot harder to deal with. It's going to be a very, very similar situation to what you are dealing with now, but long term it's going to be harder to deal with those weeds.
I would be personally
my opinion is be glad you didn't put it down, because now you are at least dealing with a landscape bed that is easier to maintain. Overall, you might have more weeds initially, but in the long run, we're talking 5-10 years, they're going to pull out a lot easy. So a lot of hand pulling. Gardeners.
And this weather that we're having, it's dry, and one of my diatribes was going to be about watering as well, but I skipped that. For some reason, it's very dry, so you can actually do a good job at reducing the weeds that you have now. They're struggling just as well as your plants are. So you start taking these up, cultivating a little bit, pulling out these weeds. I was going to say you're using this fabric, but you didn't mention any kind of mulch.
Yes, I used mulch on one part of the garden. I used a fabric on another little section, trying everything out. Yep. And when I used the mulch, the grass grew up around the mulch,
all right,
too.
So what you want to do is, if you're willing and have the energy, would be to take this a section at a time, pull up either the fabric or the rake off the mulch that you have there, and weed thoroughly with some kind of, would certainly use some kind of cultivating tool. So you're actually digging up the weeds and shaking off the soil until the soil is nice and bare and soft and clean and you don't see any weeds in there. And then put back that mulch.
Okay.
And then go get some more mulch and do the other sections. So that once the soil is pretty much devoid of any root material from those weeds, you will certainly see a weed here or there pop up, especially when it rains again, but you'll be amazed at how much better it looks.
Yep, and then you'll be easier to. And when you do mulch, you want to try to go down between around woody plants in particular, 2 to 3 inches. Now, perennials gardens and vegetable gardens, I wouldn't, use a bark wood chip, I don't think. But
what kind of mulch would you use?
For a perennial garden?
Well,
I usually top dress with like a compost type of product, because that's going to give you a really good, healthy soil condition at the same time helping to suppress weeds. Right. There's also another product if you have room around your plants. It's called Burnout. And there's other products that, no loyalty to any particular name, but it's basically made by the essential active ingredient is a type of strong vinegar, and 100% organic. And if it does get on your hand, it's not a bad thing. And it's a foliar burner. It basically acts as a mechanism to kill the weeds, but it's not really great if you're spraying around really close plants.
Right.
Weeding, getting to root.
All right, Linda, thanks a lot. So could you not just put some mulch down and then spray some or pour some strong vinegar in between the plants?
That's effective, but as long as you're not pouring, so you really want to spray. You don't want to pour, because then you're getting so much into the soil that next thing you know you're changing pHs and stuff.
Okay.
So
it's
spraying it on
foliar contact.
Yeah, and only going to kill it exactly by killing, actually hitting the foliage and burning it. It's not going to kill the root.
Okay, let's go to Ross and Ashley. Ross.
Oh.
Hey, you're on.
All right, sorry.
It's okay.
This is a question probably for Mr. Ward. I'm in Ashley Falls. I just bought a house down there right near the nursery. And the lawn is really rough. We have creeping thyme. It's really very sandy soil. And it's just the grass is really in rough shape. So I'm looking for a starter. Like, where do I start to get a reasonable lawn? I'm not looking for a golf course.
Well, knowing exactly where you are, it's tricky to grow a lawn. That is very sandy soil there. Applying organic matter, to the surface, adding organic matter to what topsoil exists is really what's recommended. it means adding quite a bit because, again, it will break down. It will disappear pretty rapidly. So during these times, I guess what I'm trying to do is lean you toward maybe letting your lawn go a bit dormant at this point and doing all this in the fall when you have a bit more moisture and a bit more cooler weather. So what you would do is top dress with some compost. You would then maybe an inch or two, then reseed. You can add a little bit of nutrients, a little bit of fertilizer at that time as well. And that will just kind of give you a much stronger base from which to maintain your lawn. And then next year, when it gets dry like this again, mowing fairly high and less frequently will allow the plant, though they'll still go dormant and turn sort of brownish, it'll allow the plant to survive this drier weather and then pop up again in the fall.
Ross, we have a bad connection. I apologize, but it did not sound good. I hope you got all that answer. So, all right.
Yep.
You basically wait till the fall, and then you rip up all the weeds, and you put some organic material down and reseed. Does it grow in time for winter? Or
you don't have to actually rip up the weeds. You can put the compost over what's existing.
Okay.
And what's, you know, if you're concerned with the weeds that are growing there, he mentioned thyme. I kind of like thyme in my garden. It's fragrant. It's interesting.
It's his lawn.
And it is his lawn. And it probably is not going to go away without some serious, weed preventative work, you know, some herbicides. If otherwise, he's going to, struggling with that.
Yeah.
So I would certainly put down the compost without pulling up the lawn in this case, and then overseed into the compost area, and then everything will come up. The existing thyme and or grasses that are below the compost will actually come through as well. So everything just sort of comes through. Now, you want to create a golf course, then you would kill everything first. What's generally recommended is to either take that away by rototilling it in or spraying it with some herbicide. The burnout product would be pretty effective in this case, so that everything is dead. Again, adding some kind of better soil compost in addition, and then overseeding the entire area is also
okay.
Going to work out.
Yeah, but a trick to keep in mind for all the listeners really is one way to keep your lawn from going so dormant and dry and brown and really stressing it out this time of year is to mow generally just a little bit higher across the whole season. And the temptation is in the spring when it's growing fast, you know, let's mow it down a little shorter.
We don't have to mow it so often.
So you don't have to do
often.
It so often. Yeah. But then the drawback to that is that this time of year, you're the guy or the woman on the street with the brown lawn.
Yeah.
If you just mow it a little bit higher throughout the season, you tend to have more photosynthetic material and lawn stays a lot greener. I mean, we don't mow our lawn at all, three times, four times a year. And our lawn is beautifully green. But again, we don't mow it very often.
My lawn is beautifully brown at the moment. Susie and Niskayuna, you're on. Susie.
Oh, hello. Yes. My question concerns porcelain berry, that vine. Are you familiar with that?
I am.
Yep.
Okay. And my second question is about lamium. But I was naively watching my porcelain berry, which had been there for several years, grow and grow and grow, and it had grown all over the dogwood, the variegated dogwood, and then it was growing up the arborvitae. Well, I just realized it was coiling itself around, and I wanted to know if those coils, I have now, pulled it all out, and I wanted to know if those coils on my variegated dogwood are going to be doing some harm.
Oh, for sure. I mean, You want to cut those off as well.
Oh, my God. That's going to be quite a job.
there really are a couple of classification of vines, but some vines could be classified as killer vines. Killer vines or strangling vines are the ones that wrap around trees, and they attach themselves by wrapping around not just trees, anything, fences, houses, plants.
Yeah.
That's how they climb. Those kinds are the problem kinds of vines for trees because they, in essence, strangle them. The other kinds of vines are more like they attach themselves with little tendrils or little coils, like a Boston ivy, for example, attaches
that's
with
this
these.
Type,
little,
yeah.
Yeah, that's like a little ET fingers, and those actually don't kill. Don't kill. I mean, you see English ivy growing up trees, and the trees look fine, and they're not going to really kill the tree. Bittersweet will strangle that tree right out and kill it.
Yeah, and so it sounds like you were saying that they're wrapping around, but that they also have tendrils.
Well, I pulled it all out. I haven't completely dug out the plant. I pulled it all off of the dogwood and the arborvitae.
Right.
But the tendrils, the coiled tendrils, remain.
If they're constricting the wood is what we're getting at,
yep.
You know, just going all the way
yeah.
around a stem, then that can be detrimental unless you've somehow damaged them so that they're dry and dead and are just going to flake off in a little while. If they're alive still and around the stem, that's not a good idea.
How could they be alive if the whole plant is gone?
Well, there you go. That's what we're trying to figure out. So if they're not alive, you know, it's just pieces of the plant and they're small pieces and they're going to decay and flake off, it's probably
not a big deal.
Oh, okay. And should I be concerned about, like, my Lamium is just, wow, you know, really taken off, three different varieties. Now it's invading the Vinca vine, the periwinkle. Should I be concerned about that?
You probably have to divide some of that out.
Yeah, I mean,
it tends to spread.
You can just edge those things, you know. You just take your edger and draw a line in the sand or in the garden and cut into it there and then pull up whatever is on the other side of the line, and that will suffice for, you know, probably the rest of this season. You'll have to do it again next year.
Susan?
Yeah, right.
Susie,
right.
We got to move it along. Thank you very much.
Bye now.
Bye. Let's go to Gail in Old Chatham. Hi, Gail.
Hi.
You're on.
I love hollyhocks, and finally have two nice stands established up on my mother's perennial garden. One's on the south side of her house, one's on the west. The plants on the west leaves, they're now in full bloom, almost to the top of their spikes. The leaves are turning brown and have little sort of spots. It looks sort of like a fungus on them.
Rust. Hollyhocks get a rust. The interesting that you said the south side doesn't have it and the west side does.
The south is gorgeous.
Yeah, because,
gorgeous.
You know, rust is a fungus, and fungi, they hatch out. Those spores are able to hatch out when they've been wet, when the leaf has had some, you know, damp residue on it for an extended period of time. I don't know what that is, but usually 8, 10, 12 hours. I don't think it's 24. Mm-hmm. It might be 24 hours. And so the west side obviously stayed wetter longer than the south side. Or there's some prevailing winds blowing the spores to the west side and not the south side.
Yeah.
Could be one or the other.
There
are some controls for that. Usually, if you read about that a little bit, one of the things to do is, as all diseases, you know, to deal with them preventatively and to try these controls before you actually see signs of the rust, or when you begin to see signs of the rust. Then to try consider simply pinching off those leaves. So this is just in the beginning before it really gets carried away, and that can often just alleviate the issue whatsoever. At this point, probably pretty heavy, pretty tall. The plants are trying to bloom. Taking off the leaves is not going to be great, or, you know, make it too pretty. But there's not a whole lot to do. So to the west side. So maybe the south side you could consider treating with a little anti-rust fungicide.
All right, Gail, thanks a lot. We're just about out of town. Let's go for one more. Pete in Poughkeepsie, you have about 1 minute to obsess about squirrels. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'll make it quick. We have probably 10 beautiful blueberry bushes laden with blueberries, but a bunch of squirrels are getting to them first, and the humans are not getting any blueberries.
Greg is wincing right now.
I tell you, I got the same problem, and I am eliminating the squirrels. I hate to say it, but that's what I'm doing.
Any humane alternative?
Well, yeah. No, it's humane. I don't know if I can. I'm supposed to say this on this, but we're moving them away.
Well, you know, you're not allowed to do that in some spots.
No, you're not.
So be careful if you do that, Pete. You know, I would suggest talking sternly to them.
Breaking up a family?
The first thing I would consider, actually, is what you're doing to protect the fruit from the squirrels. Are you providing any kind of netting whatsoever? Any kind of protection?
Yeah, we have bird netting, and I thought about
bunching it at the bottom and trying to keep them out that way.
Yeah, so yeah,
we've done that at our house. My wife and I have blueberries, and it's not like foolproof. You got to kind of be on it, but that bird netting seems to slow them down, and we've been able to control them
framing,
to some degree that
actually
way.
Framing the netting is so that the netting is not actually touching the plants,
exactly,
so that the fruit is not that close. If you can build some kind of frame, and the bottom should be fairly firm so they aren't kind of trying to tuck their heads underneath there.
Right.
And if you do that, then that usually keeps them out, and that's been pretty effective.
Pete, we're out of time, my friend, but good luck, okay?
Thank you. Thanks.
Thanks a lot. All right, that's it, gentlemen. Very good job today. Sorry if you didn't make it through. Try earlier next time. These guys will be back next month. Support for Vox Pop comes from the Phantom Gardener Nursery, Rhinebeck, New York, dedicated to helping gardeners go green with native plants, organic seedlings, and supplies, organic from the start, sustainable for the future, thephantomgardener.com. Ventfort Hall, Lenox, Massachusetts, presenting Clara, a summer play. Clara Schumann, wife of Robert, mother of eight, concert pianist, opening July 6th through September 2nd, gildedage.org. 20th Century Illuminations, New Salem, Massachusetts, presenting Beyond Genocide, the traveling exhibition of contemporary illuminated manuscripts exploring the international legacy of genocide, 20thcenturyilluminations.com. And River Valley Market, Northampton, Massachusetts, open 8 to 9 daily, featuring a full-service meat department with grass-fed, locally raised beef and house-made sausages, rivervalleymarket.coop. Thanks again for joining us today, our engineer Zach Malloy. Thanks to Melissa Wednesday Bunning for answering the phones today, our producer Patrick Donges. I'm Ray Graff. Moyers and Company tomorrow. And then on Monday, it's Vox Pop once again, Medical Monday. We will talk podiatry with Dr. Douglas Tooman. Stay tuned now for a news update.